Good evening, everyone. I'm Linor Mudu. Welcome to Health Chat. The Global Preparedness Monitoring Board, an independent group of experts focused on global health emergencies, recently released a report and they assessed the world's current preparedness for a major health crisis. The report calls on the report is called A World at Risk, and the report concludes that, among other things, that the world might not be prepared for such crisis right now. Very concerning. I sat down with Elhaj Assi. He's Secretary General of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies and co-chair of the Global Preparedness Monitoring Board, and we discussed some of the findings in the report. Take a listen.
Mr. Assi, thank you so much for your time. You're part of the Global Preparedness Monitoring Board, and the board just released a report that reveals that the world is not prepared for a major health crisis, even though there is a real threat. What do you think are some of the significant aspects of these reports?
It is at all levels. You know, when you face health shocks and hazards, it requires responses and leadership at all levels. All the way from an individual level, the health-seeking behavior is an individual decision. At the community level, and the attitudes that will either enable that or inhibit it, or the enabling environment that can be created, you know, by government and other social determinants at the national level, and globally, you know, this international solidarity that is required to fill the gaps and disparities that we see in capacity, we see in surveillance, we see in funding, and then we see in rapid response. So that's the reason why this report is calling on all leaders at all levels to take the appropriate measures to respond effectively.
So what are some of the biggest threats that the world is faced with?
The biggest threat that we are facing, of course, we know the big nasty ones that we are dealing with today, the hemorrhagic fevers such as Ebola that we experience going more and more into cities, going more and more inter-country, unlike what we used to see in the past, that it was quarantining itself in remote areas, and that in a global world, it is a big threat. But we talk about Ebola, we could talk about the Lassa fevers, we talk about the Marburg fevers, we talk about the Nile fevers, all those ones, you know, that are happening almost, you know, on a monthly basis at any point in time in any part of the world that can go wild, particularly if they're happening in places that are fragile settings, and unfortunately, many of those places where we have the outbreaks are fragile settings. But the big threat really is related to maybe two. One big one is the respiratory infection, like an influenza type, you know, that can spread within days, you know, all across the globe, you know, that we believe that the world is not prepared for that. And we go back to 100 years ago when we have the Spanish flu that killed over 50 million people. God forbid if something like that happened, it may be a great threat to humanity. But also in a fragile world, we are also quite worried about health security in many ways. You know, the deliberate release, you know, of bacteria and viruses, you know, can become almost a biological warfare and then represent a threat. All this boils down back to what we're calling for. Leadership to engage, communities to engage, funding gaps, you know, to be filled, and solidarities to be maintained so that we have a true local response for a global problem.
Funding is a big problem. You just mentioned funding gap. How do we close the gap when it comes to funding when there are so many priorities in health, at least in countries that are underdeveloped and developing? How do they address that?
Funding in health as an investment. It is not just an expense. It is not, you know, just a charity. It is an investment with economic returns. And domestic resource mobilization, domestic funding is critical. And we have so many promises that have been made in that, the national government to allocate a certain percentage of their income, their GDP, to health, and they have to respect that. But even if they do, then there will still be a gap. And that's where the international solidarity comes in. You know, institutions like the World Bank, you know, we have facilities for funding, both in terms of grants as well as in forms of loans. The multilateral corporations, you know, through the different agencies, from the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, Malaria, to the Gavi Alliance, to UNITAID, and all these mechanisms that are being put in place, you know, to fill the gaps, to the bilateral programs, you know, where also solidarity among nations, you know, will be making a big difference, not to forget about the private sector and the private foundations, which are playing now more and more an important role in the spirit of solidarity, in the spirit of protecting the one humanity we have together.
So what are some of the key indicators that reveal that a country is prepared to face disasters, or does it depend on the country's GDP or other factors?
It will depend, you know, on the status of the health system in the country. How strong or how weak the health system is, it will depend on the surveillance capacity, the weakness or the strength of it. It will depend also on the interface between the community surveillance systems and community engagement with the formal systems, you know, of the public health. It will depend pretty much also on the level of investment and leadership that is exercised at country level to do that. And it will depend very importantly to the level of respect and implementation of the international health regulations, which are commitments, you know, made at the global level that also requires, you know, countries, you know, to fulfill those promises and those obligations.
To what extent is climate change affecting disaster preparedness, whether it's the type of outbreaks that we are seeing or we may see in the future?
In many ways, because, you know, climate change will lead to fragilities. And if you have fragilities, people will be developing strategies of survival that put them at risk, you know, themselves. If you have those fragilities, people will be moving, getting out of home because home is no longer safe. Then being in situations of refuge, between civilized situation of migration. And all those will exacerbate, you know, the kind of dysfunctionalities that we see, the risks and the vulnerabilities, you know, at the same time. If we have climate change continuing the way it is, we will be encroaching now more and more in the natural habitats of the fauna, and the cohabitation that we will have that is closer and closer between fauna and humans, you know, is something that can be deadly, because the animals can live with many of the viruses and bacteria. We cannot survive it. So having a One Health approach that relates also environment and climate, animal health and human health, you know, will be the type of integration that we will also would like to see. And none of that will happen unless we have the type of leadership that is required, that we are calling for, and that's why this report emphasizes so much leadership as key.
And Mr. Asi, finally, what is the main takeaway then from this report?
The main takeaway of this report is that we will give in a very independent way, in a sometimes a blunt way, what is the state of the situation. But it's not enough. We would like also to incentivize action. And we have 7 recommendations in this report, clearly recommending what needs to be done, you know, to make a difference. Inaction has a very high cost, but there is an opportunity to make a difference. And this report highlights those opportunities, and also highlighting some indicators that we will be monitoring very closely, so that 1 year from now, when we watch, we will see progress. And where we don't see progress, we also come up with the required recommendations to move forward.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And that was Elhaj Asi, Secretary General of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies and co-chair of the Global Preparedness Monitoring Board. We spoke to the other co-chair of the Global Preparedness Monitoring Board as well, Dr. Gro Harlem Brundtland. She is a former Prime Minister of Norway and a former Director General of the World Health Assembly. Dr. Brundtland elaborates on the need for leaders to step up efforts to better prepare the countries for health emergencies.
Dr. Brundtland, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
You are a former Prime Minister of Norway and served as Director General of the World Health Organization from 1998 to 2003. The new report that was just released by the Global Preparedness Monitoring Board really emphasizes the importance and the need for leaders and governments to take action when it comes to preparedness. So many times we hear lack of political will. What is needed today when we look at what is at stake?
Having looked at the analysis and the recommendations that have been made already by the Secretary General's panel after the terrible Ebola outbreak four or five years ago, we have seen that the follow-up to all the necessary work that needs to be done to increase the world preparedness for such outbreaks have been going too slowly. Much of it has not been implemented, and it is not a question of only the health ministries or the health ministers in the world. This is a government responsibility. It is the government leaders who are responsible, because this is a question of health security for the populations of each country and, of course, the population of the world. So it is our leaders who have to take this seriously. And the large gaps that we have illustrated and told about now need to be filled. So next year we will be reporting again and looking at certain criteria about what has been done in the year from now until next year. We need really to be approaching much more tough accountability and monitoring to see that things in fact happen.
So when we look at how important preparedness is in today's health agenda, to what extent should it be included in policies, whether it's at the local level or at the global level?
So preparedness has to happen at the community level, regional and country level, and of course at the international level, because these things are interlinked from each individual who falls ill and can carry an infectious disease that can spread to something that can spread across the world to millions of people, like we saw in 1918 with the big influenza pandemic that killed many millions of people and ravaged economies and really created havoc. This is kind of one of the dramatic emergencies that could reoccur. We don't know when, but we can be reasonably sure that it will happen. And then we need to be much better prepared to avoid loss of human life and undermining of our economies, as would be the result.
What lessons can we learn from what is happening right now with the Ebola outbreak in the DRC? The country went through 9 outbreaks in the past. They fairly did a good job at containing it. This time around, it's very much devastating.
You know, as you say, when I was Director General many years ago, Ebola outbreaks happened in the Congo. And within weeks, or even at least months, they had all been contained, sending experts and helping from the CDC Atlanta and from WHO, helping contain. But they were limited outbreaks. Now they have spread to broader regions. And in a country that is in conflict and strife, which means that there is not sufficient public trust. So you have the kind of problem that you also see with polio vaccination. Some countries are or people and communities are suspicious of the health personnel that come to vaccinate the children. And when you have conflict, everything becomes more complicated, which is the situation in the Congo. But a lot of resources have been used, and also a vaccine is being used, which gives quite good results. So we are improving, but already 350 million dollars have been used in the DRC Congo for this outbreak.
When we look at preparedness in general and facing disasters, whether they're man-made or natural disasters, to what extent do the preparedness differ?
Well, you know, any country needs to have primary healthcare services. Otherwise, people don't know where to go even when they fall ill. The other one, you need to have diagnostics. You need to have a central, at least, laboratory capacity that can analyze timely and sufficiently. So we know what kind of contagion is there. So there are a number of specific things that need to be in place so that we can be prepared to contain.
And finally, Dr. Brentlander, what is the message then when we look at what's happening today and what the world has to be faced with?
You know, today I have been at the summit on the universal health coverage at the United Nations, and we are speaking about the Global Preparedness Monitoring Board, which is part of a broader attention to health and to security for the whole population. These things are, of course, linked together. Without a primary healthcare system, and I think without universal health coverage, we will not be as prepared as we should be, even for epidemic outbreaks. So this all goes together. You need to invest in people. We all need to invest in people to avoid negative consequences.
And that was Dr. Gro Harlem Brundtland. She is Director Emeritus of the World Health Organization and former Prime Minister of Norway. Now it's time for a short break. We'll be right back, so don't go away.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
Escape from the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of The Voice of America's African Beat. Splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical jam. I guarantee it.
African Beats.
Welcome back to Health Chat. Earlier this year, the country of Cape Verde held the second World Health Organization's Africa Health Forum with the focus on how to provide universal health care to people on the continent. The World Health Organization's Africa Acting Director for Health Systems and Services Cluster, Prosper Tumusime, spoke to Richie Schreier about progress that has been made since the last conference, continued challenges, and more. Take a listen.
There has been quite a lot of movement. There has been, from the side of the WHO that supports the countries, we've had a program called the UHC Flagship that works through sending out scoping missions to countries. And so far we've visited about 10 countries. What we do is that we go and sit down with the countries and the stakeholders, with the partners and government departments, and discuss their priorities for the health sector, and then agree on what out of those could be actually rolled out to improve the coverage for universal health.
As I understand it, at the conference, there's a innovation, a challenge exhibition. Have you gotten a chance to visit it? And if so, did you see anything that inspired you?
Yes, there's a universal challenge here. So there are some, for example, that use their technology for information, gathering information that is taken from clients and so on to aid the service delivery as they move on. There are quite a number of them. There are others which are on financing and the sort. So it's quite a good amount. And these are mainly youth, the young guys, the young people.
What are the main challenges to implementing universal healthcare in Africa? And Africa is a huge region, so I'm sure there are different challenges based on different spots.
No, that's correct. There are different challenges because the countries differ. There are different types of countries. We have countries that are in the federal state. We have countries that have a lot of fragile situations. We have small countries which are like island countries that have peculiar challenges with climate change and things like that. Then we do have, of course, also countries, for example, that are moving up from the lower income to the middle upper income countries, and they still have challenges of financing despite they have moved up a step higher as they get divorced from access to donor funding, for example. But one of the biggest challenges, I think, is galvanizing the government commitments towards moving this forward, because all this depends on how well the government commits to move the agenda forward. Of course, which requires a lot of dialogue, a lot of advocacy.
And that was Prosper Tumusime, the World Health Organization's Africa Acting Director for Health Systems and Services Cluster. He was speaking to VOA's Richie Shryok from Praia, Cape Verde. Now to Cameroon, where reporter Edwin Moki Kinzeka takes a look at the country's healthcare system in addressing babies' needs.
A two-day-old baby boy cries as his mother watches helplessly outside Sante Putus, a private hospital in Cameroon's economic capital, Douala. Francine Tamenang says she has not slept since a traditional birth attendant helped her deliver the baby.
J'ai accouché ma fille. Après deux jours, m'a dit ma fille avait une infection.
She says she wants to see the doctor because she has not got money to pay for an injection. The nurse says will save the life of the baby she delivered at home. She says the doctor has not even cared to examine the baby, but is instead promising to negotiate with the pharmacist to see if the price of the drug could be reduced. Cameroon has a population of nearly 25 million people who have been joined by 350,000 refugees fleeing the carnage in the neighboring Central African Republic and about 100,000 Nigerians escaping Boko Haram terrorism. The country also has 300,000 people internally displaced by Boko Haram conflicts in the north and the separatist crisis in its English-speaking regions. Central African refugee Emmeline Boganda says she lost her best friend at a Cameroon government health center in Betare Oya because of negligence by the hospital staff.
On ne s'occupait pas d'elle jusqu'à elle est morte. Marianne est morte sur place comme ça là.
She says she brought her friend Mariam to the health center and no one attended to her until she died. She says she has a strong feeling that if the nurses and doctors paid just a little attention, Mariam's life could have been saved. She says she does not know what hospitals are for, if not to save lives. The vice chairman of Cameroon's National Order of Doctors, Tetani Ekwe, says the health and humanitarian needs of the displaced and refugees increase by the day, yet the doctor-patient ratio stands at one doctor per 50,000 inhabitants in rural areas instead of the one doctor per 10,000 inhabitants recommended by the World Health Organization. He says in towns like Douala and Yaoundé, the doctor-patient ratio does meet the WHO standard.
Là où le bât blesse, c'est qu'il n'y a pas suffisamment de médecins, pas suffisamment d'infirmiers en termes de qualité.
He says while only 15 to 20% of Cameroonians go to conventional health centers, the acute shortage of medical doctors, trained nurses and laboratory technicians means not all of them can be attended to. He says with the lack of universal health coverage plans, sick people, who are quite often the very poor, cannot pay their hospital bills and resort to Cameroon traditional medicine, some of which is not scientifically proven to be effective. More than 500 medical doctors and 5,000 nurses are trained in Cameroon every year. But in 1996, when the economy worsened, the pay of doctors was reduced by 60% to about $300 per month, and many of them went abroad. Some still live now, complaining of low pay. In August, Cameroon reported that medical staff were fleeing hospitals in the troubled English-speaking regions after attacks left several nurses dead and many others wounded. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
And that was VOA's Moki Edwin Kinzeka reporting from Douala in Cameroon. And now, VOA's reporter Lisa Schlein takes a look at the World Health Organization's assessment on maternal mortality.
The UN agency says since 2000, child deaths have dropped by nearly one half, and maternal deaths are down by more than one third, mostly due to better access to affordable, quality health services. The new estimates, however, show that 6.2 million children under the age of 15 died last year, and nearly 300,000 women died of complications related to pregnancy and childbirth in 2017. The agency's report, a pregnant woman or newborn dies every 11 seconds somewhere in the world, mostly of preventable causes. Peter Salama is WHO's executive director of universal health coverage. He says women and children in sub-Saharan Africa are at higher risk of death than in all other regions.
In 2017, for the first time, half of all child deaths occurred in sub-Saharan Africa. Because of increasing fertility rates, we project that number to reach more than 60% of all global child deaths. For maternal deaths today, two-thirds occur in sub-Saharan Africa.
Salama says the lifetime risk of a woman dying of pregnancy-related causes is around 1 in 37 in Africa, compared to 1 in 7,800 in Australia, his home country. He says the risk of delivering a baby in countries with a stable government is far less than in countries affected by conflict. He says countries with modest means can make progress in reducing child and maternal mortality. He cites Belarus, Bangladesh, Cambodia, Malawi, and Zambia.
It's clear one reason is they've made a heavy investment in sexual, reproductive, maternal, newborn, and child health. They're choosing the right programs and they're investing accordingly in them. But that's not the whole story. They're investing in primary health care and in universal health coverage. In short, they're investing in more comprehensive and integrated systems.
The UN Sustainable Development Goals aim to reduce maternal mortality to less than 70 per 100,000 live births and under 5 child mortality to at least 25 per 1,000 live births by 2030. WHO and UNICEF say the world must act now and invest the money needed to reduce these deaths. They warn otherwise, 62 million children under the age of 5 will die between now and 2030, and more than a million maternal lives will be lost. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's all the time we have for this edition of Health Chat. Join us on facebook.com/VOA Health Chat and let's keep the conversation going. I'm your host, Lenore Moudou in Washington with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
This is V.